Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the Brian Lehrer Show podcast. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but everything we do is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
So today I'd like to share a concrete example of progress in Iraq that most Americans do not see every day in their newspapers or on their television screens. I'm going to tell you the story of a northern Iraqi city called Talafer, which was once a key base of operations for al-Qaeda and is today a free city that gives reason for hope for a free Iraq.
President Bush speaking in Cleveland last month about what's going right in Iraq. The funny thing is, says this week's New Yorker, there is at least one person who seems unwilling to replicate the victory in Tal Afar. Donald Rumsfeld. With me now is New Yorker staff writer George Packer, author of the widely praised book about the Iraq War, The Assassin's Gate. His article in this week's magazine is called The Lesson of Tal Afar. George, we appreciate you coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be back with you.
And let's hear a little more of what the president said last month about precisely how Tal Afar became a success story after falling to what the president calls terrorists and insurgents. Let's listen.
We recognize the situation was unacceptable. So we launched a military operation against them. After 3 days of heavy fighting, the terrorists and the insurgents fled the city. Our strategy at the time was to stay after the terrorists and keep them on the run. So coalition forces kept moving, kept pursuing the enemy and routing out the terrorists in other parts of Iraq. Unfortunately, in 2004, the local security forces there in Tal Afar weren't able to maintain order. And so the terrorists and the insurgents eventually moved back into the town. The ability of al-Qaeda and its associates to retake Tal Afar was an example of something we saw elsewhere in Iraq. We recognized the problem, and we changed our strategy. Instead of coming in and removing the terrorists and then moving on, the Iraqi government and the coalition adopted a new approach called clear, hold, and build. This new approach was made possible because of the significant gains made in training large numbers of highly capable Iraqi security forces. Under this new approach, Iraqi and coalition forces would clear a city of the terrorists, leave well-trained Iraqi units behind to hold the city, and work with local leaders to build the economic and political infrastructure Iraqis need to live in freedom.
To build the economic and political infrastructure Iraqis need to live in freedom, the president from his March 20th speech in Cleveland. So, George Packer, based on your reporting, was the president right in that clip about what happened in Tal Afar and what has been going well there?
I would say he's half right. I was there in Tal Afar in January and spent a lot of time in the city and saw pretty remarkable progress given what the city was like in the middle of 2005, which is to say it was really a Fallujah in the north with a reign of terror being inflicted on the city and especially on its Shiite minority by extremist Sunni insurgents with somewhat with the cooperation of the local Sunni population. And now I could walk around parts of the city without too much fear. I didn't hear very many shots being fired, and there's a very heavy presence of both Iraqi army and American soldiers. But what the president left out is that the reason why Tal Afar kept falling back into the hands of insurgents is we did not have enough troops in the north as throughout Iraq to stay in the city. What the unit that cleared it out in the fall of 2004 left behind was a company, 150 men. For a city of 250,000 people. Now there's 1,000 Americans, or there were when I was there in January, 1,000 Americans, because the Army decided Tal Afar was strategically important enough that they were just going to commit those forces to Tal Afar. but it's not representative. We don't have those kinds of forces in other cities. Tal Afar, in a way, is the exception to the rule in Iraq. And the other point the president doesn't make is that the success of Colonel H.R. McMaster and his 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Tal Afar is not owing to administration strategy. It's in spite of administration strategy. It was really the work of commanders on the ground who were, in a sense, improvising their own counterinsurgency in the absence of real guidance from above. They were, as I say in the piece, rebels against an incoherent strategy coming from Washington. So it's not a testament to Washington getting it right. It's a testament to soldiers on the ground getting it right in the absence of what they needed from Washington.
At the end of that clip, as I highlighted, as it ended, the president said Iraqi and coalition forces worked with local leaders to build the economic and political infrastructure. And that sounds like the kind of nation building the president campaigned against when he first ran for president. Has he had a change of heart based on Tal Afar?
Well, it's no secret that Iraq has become the most massive nation building project America has undertaken since Vietnam, if not since the end of World War II. And I think without ever admitting it, the administration has accepted that, at least in theory. But in practice, one always finds the effort falls far short of the rhetoric. And that may be because, in the end, they really haven't fully embraced nation building. It's undeniable that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has not embraced it. He gave speeches against it before the war in Iraq. And since the invasion, he's continued to act as if this is a kind of distraction from the main business of transforming the military and fighting the global war on terror. And you just feel that he does not want to be in Iraq. He does not want to devote his resources to it. If you look at his new quadrennial defense review, the budget priorities are on big weapon systems and not on building more divisions, which are obviously needed in Iraq. So you have to get past the rhetoric of clear hold and build or of economic and political development to what is actually done and how much is spent and how much political capital. And you find it's actually a pretty paltry effort given the need in Iraq.
In fact, you quote the mayor of Tal Afar as saying it will take at least 3 years for the Iraqification process to work, for troops to be sufficiently trained and for the political unity to be sufficiently developed between Sunnis and Shiites and Turkmen in the city, that only the U.S. can accomplish that, and it would take 3 years. Would Rumsfeld disagree with the mayor of Tal Afar on that assessment?
I don't know what he would say in public, but I'm fairly certain that in private he would say, my army is not going to be in Iraq when this administration leaves office to the tune of 130 or 150,000 soldiers. We have other things to do with that army. And, of course, a lot of officers are worried that the army is being broken by the repeated deployments to Iraq. They're losing junior officers. They're afraid they're going to lose senior non-commissioned officers. So there are real strains. But either we're fighting this war or we're not. And the sort of half-hearted effort that has come out of the Office of the Secretary of Defense is demoralizing. And off the record, soldiers are pretty free with derision and contempt for Secretary Rumsfeld because they understand he's not behind them. So Tal Afar, you know, I don't even know if Tal Afar is going to hold over the next few months because that unit that secured it is now out. This is part of the problem in Iraq, these constant rotations in and out. There's a new unit there. It's going to take them months to build up the relationships and the trust that the 3rd ACR built up over 2005. That's the nature of this war. It's about personal relationships. And the American soldiers I met in Tal Afar understood that deeply. I don't think their senior leadership understands it yet.
And that's exactly, according to your article, what the local U.S. Commander there, Colonel McMaster, who President Bush praised by name in that speech, who you dwell on in the article for his intensity with respect to building relationships with the various populations in Tal Afar, and who actually wrote a book called Dereliction of Duty about how the Johnson administration blew various things and wouldn't look the truth in the eye during the Vietnam War. This Colonel McMaster, he's gone from there now?
He's gone. He's back at Fort Carson, Colorado. And although I wish him, you know, happiness back with his family, and he absolutely deserves to be home again, I'm not sure that we can win this war if our best commanders, with all the knowledge they've gained over 9 months or a year in Iraq, then go on to some other command or some training post or start teaching or go off to a foreign capital. And meanwhile, the Iraq war continues to go badly. And that's been the nature of this war. The military has not committed itself even as fully as it did to Vietnam. But you mentioned his book, Dereliction of Duty. It's extremely relevant here because that book is about the failure of the senior military leadership to speak truth to power, to tell McNamara and Johnson that their strategy was bound to fail. And instead, they protected their careers and their service branches and kept their thoughts to themselves. And we have seen a repetition of that. You could take sentences out of McMaster's book and just change McNamara for Rumsfeld, and the sentence could stand. And so there's a, I think, not just a failure on the part of Rumsfeld, but on the part of senior generals to either force Rumsfeld to face the truth or to resign. We haven't seen high-profile resignations from the military, and I wonder about that because they do have an obligation to the troops below them as well as to the men above them in the chain of command.
It's interesting because usually when we hear calls for Rumsfeld's resignation, it's because of failures up to this point in the Iraq war. It sounds like you'd like to see him resign because of his plans going forward.
I'd like him to resign so that we have a chance to win.
My guest on WNYC is George Packer, author of the book about the Iraq War, The Assassin's Gate, and author of the article in this week's New Yorker, The Lesson of Tal Afar. And we can take phone calls for George Packer at 212-433-WNYC. Call us now, 212-433-9692. To me, the most telling line of your article, I mean, there's so much good reporting in here, but you kind of boil it down to when you write that in one sense, the two wars, Vietnam and Iraq, are the opposite of each other. In Vietnam, Johnson claimed to be staying out as he was actually getting in. In Iraq, Bush claims to be staying in as we're actually getting out. But we are?
That's the feeling I got in Iraq, because I didn't just go to Tal Afar. I went to a number of other sectors, and Tal Afar came to seem more and more like a kind of lonely, bright light in an overall picture of American forces being consolidated on gigantic bases far from Iraqi cities where they have all kinds of Baskin-Robbins ice cream and movie theaters and gyms, and they never see Iraqis. And it's the nature of this kind of war and insurgency that if you're not around Iraqis, you're really not helping to prosecute the war. It's going to be won or lost in the way that American soldiers and Iraqi security forces and civilians are able to secure the population. That's counterinsurgency. I don't think we're doing that. We're going the opposite direction of pulling back, consolidating. And I think, I'm not sure about this, but I have it from both Iraqi officials and some American military that the plan is essentially to get down below 100,000 foreign troops by the end of the year, and half of that by the middle of next year. Now, obviously, things can upset those plans, and I think very soon the Pentagon's going to have to make decisions about the next rotation. But that was the overwhelming feeling I got from officers and men, that they feel they're on the way out. One sergeant said to me, in some form we'll be here for 10 years, but boots on the ground-wise, we're almost done. In other words, the big troop presence is just about over. The Army is going to start drawing down this year.
So we have to take a break, but when we come back in a minute, I want to ask you if you think there is literally a debate taking place within the Bush administration between the president, who wants to stay and try to win the war McMaster style, and the defense secretary, who wants a cover of Iraqification and then pull out. So we'll answer that in a minute.
Great
and
question.
We'll start taking phone calls for George Packer from The New Yorker and author of the book The Assassin's Gate, 212-433-WNYC. Stay tuned.
It was important to listen to the representatives of Tal Afar's many ethnic and religious groups. It's an important part of helping to remove one of the leading sources of mistrust.
Again, President Bush from his March 20th speech in Cleveland, using Tal Afar as a success story, as an example of success in the Iraq War, and again invoking that building of ethnic and religious groups and the trust along sectarian lines, as we talk about it with George Packer from The New Yorker. And George, you know, I was just thinking during the break, as much emphasis as the president put on Tal Afar and as much press as he got around that speech, and he really dwelled on it for minute after minute after minute in that speech, when you were talking before about the rotation taking McMaster out and his people out and the possibility that Tal Afar would not hold, if that place of all places falls, how humiliating and dispiriting it must be, or it would be if that happens. I can't imagine the Pentagon allowing that to happen.
Well, you're right, and there's a lot of pressure on the poor guys from the 1st Armored Division who have gone in place of McMaster's unit to hold it. I mean, they've basically been told, this is our success story. You better not blow it. But the problem is, I mean, I'm sure they'll do everything they can. There's a battalion in the city, so it's slightly less than the number that McMaster had, but it's still pretty substantial. The problem is, it's just in the nature of this war that firepower and armored vehicles, although they're part of it, are not the key to it. The key is knowledge and relationships, and that's what McMaster understood and built up over many long months of endless, inconclusive meetings with local sheikhs and with their counterparts in the Iraqi army, so that finally a certain degree of trust began to be built up, and with it the kind of intelligence that they needed in order to start to find the insurgents. That takes months. It is just absolutely no shortcut. And I don't know that our country, including our military, has the patience. It's almost in our culture to want to get it done quickly. And when the mayor of Tal Afar said 3 years at least, that's not a figure that most Americans are going to be comfortable with. We sort of think if we can't do it in the next few months, then obviously it can't be done, and so we should get out. And that's what that's the political atmosphere the president is trying to work within now, and he's partly to blame for it.
So is there a debate between the president, who wants to stay and try to win the war McMaster style, and the defense secretary, who wants a cover of Iraqification with Iraqi troops and then pull out?
You know, I can't quite understand what goes on. I mean, I'll give you an example. There are people in the administration, especially at the State Department, who think protecting Iraqi infrastructure is crucial right now. I mean, the insurgents have had huge success at cutting off electricity and creating power and fuel shortages. Baghdad is being strangled, and Baghdad, of course, is the key to the war. The Secretary of Defense does not want to commit American forces to that mission, to protect infrastructure. He thinks Iraqi troops ought to be able to do it. Well, the Iraqi troops are not able to do it, and some of them are corrupt and are taking money in order to look the other way. Why hasn't President Bush told Secretary Rumsfeld, this will be a mission of the United States military? I honestly am not sure. Either President Bush doesn't have all the information that he needs because people around him are afraid to give him the truth, which we've seen over and over again on Iraq and other issues.
You don't think he reads The New Yorker every week?
Somehow I'm just not convinced it's getting into the Oval Office. And if it is, he may think that writers like me are part of the problem, because there's a new strategy out in the administration to essentially say the press is only reporting bad news, and that's why the public is losing confidence, and essentially to say the press is losing Iraq, which is a desperate kind of late our gambit. But either Bush doesn't know or can't be bothered with such details, or he just doesn't want to confront his Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld has had his way over and over and over again, and Cheney, let's not forget him, is still a very powerful protector for Rumsfeld in the White House. So there may be soldiers like McMaster, even Secretary of State Rice from the outside, who are calling for a redoubled effort. But you've still got two extremely big, powerful, bureaucratic players in Cheney and Rumsfeld who have been, in my view, the problem all along, and they may well still have the president in their grip. So he may believe his own rhetoric. I think he does. I think he believes that we have to win this war. I think he knows that this is his legacy. I really do think he knows that. But he still hasn't shown that he's willing to shed enough blood bureaucratically to get it done. And honestly, that's a mystery to me, and it's going to be something for historians to try to puzzle out.
Daniel in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, when you look at, like, Michael Ware's documentary, and he talks about they estimate how many insurgents there are in Iraq, between 15 and 25,000. And when you look at how many U.S. troops there are in Iraq, around 200,000, they have to think, in World War II, one in six troops saw combat. The other five-sixths of the troops supported the combat troops. It's the same thing. You know, we have 200,000 troops over there. Only about 20,000 or 30,000 of those guys are actually really doing fighting in the whole country. And another thing is, when I was there, you know, they took away all the weapons away from us that could cause collateral damage. They took away tanks. They took away rocket launchers. They took away Paladin missiles. And, you know, the insurgents have RPGs and the Americans don't.
Daniel, what did you do in Iraq?
I was a mechanic in a combat engineer unit. I was actually in the 11th Engineer Battalion, and Sergeant First Class Paul Smith, you know, who won the Medal of Honor, he was in my unit.
Well, thank you for your service to our country. And what would you like to see the Pentagon or the president do now?
Well, you know, really, I don't know. I mean, I really think they could win this war, but, you know, they're not going to win it and be politically correct at the same time. You know, you're not going to win this war without collateral damage. You know, if you're afraid to give your troops rocket launchers, how can you win a war?
And by collateral damage, you mean killing civilians in the process of going after insurgents.
Exactly. Collateral damage as in unavoidable. You know, sometimes, you know, if you know that there's some insurgents in a certain town, you know, don't call it an insurgent stronghold. Go there and bomb it, you know. And what's happening is, you know, it's hurting the troops, because to protect Iraqi civilians, you know, American soldiers are getting killed by these insurgents who have safe havens.
Daniel, thank you for your call. George Packer, how do you respond to that?
Well, he's pointing to, you know, the really difficult nature of this war. It is about the civilians. The guys in Tal Afar said that to me over and over again. One of them said, you know, there are two ways to fight an insurgency. One is to cordon off the city and go in and level it, a la Fallujah. The other is to spend months getting to know the city, forming relationships, and then going in and eliminating individuals instead of whole city blocks. I think that soldier understood that the latter is vastly preferable. It's not just that morally killing civilians is problematic. It's that you lose the war that way. You lose the support of the civilians. We made so many mistakes in the first 2 years because we really did believe, and it's just in the nature of the military to do this. This is how they're trained. Firepower is the way to respond to an enemy. But firepower makes more enemies in a war like this, and it's been a very slow, painful process for commanders and men to learn that in Iraq, and a lot of them still haven't learned it.
Do you think the president
getting frustrated with it?
Do you think the president would agree with you that the difference between Fallujah and Tal Afar is that more force was used in Fallujah, leveling the city so much, which turned out to be counterproductive in the long run, and less force was used in Tal Afar? Would you say he has drawn that lesson?
You know, I don't know how much information reaches him. I think that there are people around him who understand that he does not want his stride broken in the march toward ridding Iraq of terrorists and making it a free country. He enunciates an extremely simple view of what we're doing, and I don't know that complicated nuances like what you just asked get to him.
That indicates
I'm not
that,
sure he grasped that level of detail of the
but
war.
That indicates that someone else is really in charge.
Well, it indicates that he's let his staff know that he doesn't want to be bothered with complications. And we find that over and over in the planning for the war, as well as in the conduct of the war since then. I think it's his great failure as a leader to not have the patience to look at details and to make decisions based on small as well as large questions. He said to Senator Joe Biden, "I don't do nuance." Unfortunately, this is a war of nuance. This is not a war of grand maneuvers, tank battles, et cetera. It's very much being fought street by street, and it requires a kind of grasp of the subtleties of those streets in order to fight it. So I can't say that he has learned the lesson of Tal Afar.
My guest on WNYC is New Yorker staff writer George Packer, who's writing in this week's article called The Lesson of Tal Afar, and in his book, The Assassin's Gate, is burdened with all kinds of nuance. Anthony in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anthony.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just one or two comments. There is nothing that's happening in Iraq today that did not occur in Vietnam over 35 years ago. And number two, as far as indirect fire and casualties are concerned, you definitely sacrifice your own troops in order to conduct a diplomatic approach to the problem. So there is no easy solution. To win the war, it takes at least 2 to 3 times the amount of troops you presently have on the ground, and that's for security. And once you have security, then you can behave diplomatically, and that is not going to happen overnight. And unfortunately, Rumsfeld and everyone who has advised the president to a quick fix and landing a plane on a carrier deck saying we've won 2 years ago has absolutely no concept, no grasp of history. And all you have to do is go back and study MACV, which is the second army that was in Vietnam. USARV was the combat, and MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, was responsible for the advisory troops, the troops on the ground who were in the hamlets and the provinces and the villages and with the province chiefs and everyone else, and doing essentially what that northern city, what that lieutenant colonel accomplished in the northern city in Iraq.
Could it
be the same thing happened 35 years ago?
Could it be done differently during an insurgent war, in your opinion, Anthony?
Well, what was Vietnam was an insurgent war.
I know.
The Viet Cong were everywhere. We had the province that I was in, we had no, there were no free fire zones. So in order to clear a fire mission, it had to go through my operations unit. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, the thing would ring off, and there'd be a fire request, and you check the coordinates, and this actually happened.
And Anthony, I'm going to leave it there and get some other people's voices on, but thank you for sharing your Vietnam experience and its relevance. Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Howdy. I've got a couple of questions. One, maybe it's possible that we don't have the number of troops available to maintain a ratio that was done in Tal Afar, and that the only strategy left is really to just increase the rate of training the troops and police and pretty much what they're doing now. And that's question number one. In other words,
right, we get it. We'll let you come back to question number two. But George, it's a good question because how many more Americans would it take, even if we have them, to do the Tal Afar approach all over Iraq?
No, the call is right that the ratio in Tal Afar is exceptional, and elsewhere we simply don't have the troops, and we're trying to fill the gap with Iraqi troops. In Tal Afar, I saw the Iraqis being trained on the job. I mean, it's not as though you train them off on a base and drill them and then send them into battle. They're being trained by doing operations side by side with the Americans. You can see the Iraqis watching the Americans carefully, kind of learning by imitation, and they're pretty good in Tal Afar. The army, the police are another matter, and they're a big problem. But the thing is, you've got to have them side by side with Americans for a long period of time. Again, there's just no shortcut. It takes a lot of patience, a lot of effort, and a lot of men. And I agree.
Do you have a number? Do you have a number? How many would it take to really do it and really win in your vision of what that means?
Well, experts say to secure a country, you really need one security force member for every, say, 40 to 50 civilians. And in Iraq, that would be you know, something like 400,000 troops or 500,000 troops. We've got about 130,000 Americans. We've got a couple of 100,000 Iraqis, but you really can't equate them with the Americans yet. The problem is, it's true we're short-handed. We have been from the start, but the Pentagon hasn't done anything to remedy that. I mean, why hasn't the budget of the Pentagon been devoted to bonuses, to pay raises, to incentives, and to building more divisions? The reason is that's not what Donald Rumsfeld wants to do with the military. He wants to spend the money on 21st century technology. Boots on the ground is his idea of the past, the old army. He's against it. That's why he ignored General Shinseki. That's been the problem all along.
Gary, real quick, what's your second question?
Well, he just touched on it. We know, I mean, I've pondered, as Mr. Packer has done, why they're not responding in a way that the administration is responding in a way of the kind of criticism. It's not that they don't know it. We know that, you know, Rumsfeld tried to do it on the cheap. They didn't foresee a insurgency that could employ IEDs and just maintain a kill ratio, maybe one person a day, just to make headlines and affect the war with a skittish population and an opposition party in the United States. We all know that, and the president has to know that.
Gary, thank you very much. George, you know, there are really two camps, at least two camps, who criticize the president and the defense secretary for their performance during this war. One camp, I guess, represented by you, says we don't have enough troops to really win the war, and what a disaster it would be if we lose. The other camp, represented mostly by Jack Murtha, most you know, publicly by Congressman Jack Murtha, says it's pointless to try to do all that. The best thing for the United States and even for Iraqis in the long run is for the U.S. to get out, to you know, because we're the hot button keeping the insurgency going. What do you think about the Murtha approach?
I think it's a fundamentally flawed analysis, because it's true that we're a target, but we're not at the source of the violence any longer. It's a struggle for the future of Iraq between different power groups, in which we're more and more in the middle rather than the targets.
And so in our last minute, what in your view is at stake for the United States?
Right. Well, I was going to get to that. It's folly to think that it's in our interest simply to get out and let Iraqis fight it out, because it's not our war. It is our war. It's not Vietnam. In Vietnam, there really were no strategic consequences around the world for our failure to win that war. In this case, I think if you have an Iraq that is prey entirely controlled by militias, by terrorists, by gangs, and with Syria, Iran, and Saudi Arabia extending their influence into it, then you've got a failed state like the Congo in the middle of the Middle East, with its oil and with its weapons, with its armed groups, with its terrorists, destabilizing the most important region in the world, the region that's at the heart of so many of our problems. We simply cannot imagine that if we leave Iraq, it's going to leave us alone. It'll be a problem for generations to come. That
George,
doesn't mean we shouldn't stay, but we should factor that in when we make the calculation.
George Packard's article in this week's New Yorker is The Lesson of Tal Afar. His book, widely praised, on the Iraq War, based on his reporting, is The Assassin's Gate. George, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.